Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the foremost experts in the field. Author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen Brown's groundbreaking work began the movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at issues surrounding the world of money and the systems and powers that control it, as well as the progress being made on the public banking frontier. The program is underwritten by Public Banking Associates, a national consultancy of experts advising government leaders pursuing creation of their own public banks at publicbankingassociates.com.
The rules of the road on the issuance of securities have been changed. Changed both at the federal level and changed in, at this point, about 37 states. And it is now using, say, investment crowdfunding, any small business go online and put some kind of ask for money, whether in the form of debt or stock investment or a royalty agreement. And they can do this for up to about $1.1 million with very, very little paperwork and expense up front. So that's a big, big change. And there's a lot of talk right now about shifting that law a little bit and making that ceiling more like $5 million for a company. And up right now, we're allowing every individual to invest up to $2,000 per year. So maybe that could be raised to $10,000 per year.
That's our guest this week on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, Michael Schumann, the person significantly responsible for opening up crowdfunding investments in the United States and redirecting our attention on investing in the country into local markets. Hello, and welcome to It's Our Money. I'm Ellen's co-host, Walt McCree. Today, we'll talk with Michael Schumann about how the world of securities investment has finally arrived on the doorsteps of Main Street America, after having been restricted to only qualified investors that possessed enough cash to be allowed to speculate in investment markets. Crowdfunding is now commonplace, and it looks like it will be with us in expanded ways for an indefinite future. In fact, it may be more important than ever, given the growing expense and uncertainty of borrowing money from the normal private markets and banks and the expensive credit cards. Another thing that Michael is well known for is his work in refocusing our investment interests on local economies, which are, as you probably know, the real drivers of employment and, of course, local economic well-being. But it was only relatively recently that such local investment methods have been available, thanks to changes in the SEC rules. Well, local investment is also a major concern in the midst of the current COVID pandemic crisis, which has put all economic expectations and practices on hold, making some, like local investment, more important than ever, while the macro investments that have been made into the global economy are being challenged to recover and project how they will fit into a post-COVID recovery. But even bigger stories are afoot with the COVID developments. Last program, we spoke with Dr. Robert Hockett about new facilities that the Federal Reserve was rolling out, which broke through historic barriers that opened up cash liquidity facilities for entirely new sectors of the public. What has evolved just since our last program is that the Fed intends to open their cash window even wider, while they relax the controls traditionally set for bank operations in the form of bank reserves and collateral. Unheard of relaxations that clearly express the emergency situation that our country is in, and of course, its monetary system. Big issues are suddenly before us, not the least of which is, why do the banks, hedge funds, and big corporations get to acquire almost free money from the Federal Reserve, while states and cities of America stand outside the Fed fountain with their hats in their hands? They've been offered some improvements in their borrowing options, yes, but nothing like the corporate interests that are truly running the show in D.C. Well, Ellen wrote a very powerful new article called The War on the States, in which she digs into the how and the why of these developments. So let's talk with Ellen now.
All of the dramatic changes that are happening in the United States economy in the last couple of months, one of the most underlying dramatic pieces is the way in which the Federal Reserve has stepped outside of its usual boundaries to provide funding for every Tom, Dick, and Harry, and Harriet, that seems to be in need. Your latest article, Ellen, is called The War on the States. Describe for us how this is shaping up in your view.
Okay, well, this problem for the states, you know, the bailout from Congress is up to $3 trillion, not counting the $4 trillion that the Federal Reserve is available to pump in for the special purpose vehicles. And of that $3 trillion, only $150 billion is allocated to the states, so that's only 5%. Compare that to $50 billion, which is going to the airlines, and it's basically like five airlines, so that's $10 billion each versus $3 billion each on the average for the states. But the worst part of it is that the states are not allowed to use it for anything that was in their budgets as of March 27th. Well, everything is in their budgets. That's how they work. They budget things first, and they plan a certain amount of taxes to pay for it. But because of the shutdown due to the coronavirus, they don't have the taxes that they had before, and that, you know, their expected taxes will be less. So they can't cover their ordinary costs. And because they're states, not the federal government, they must balance their books, unlike the federal government, which can go $1 trillion into debt every year and nobody seems to mind. Well, I mean, you hear a lot of squawks from us, you know, ordinary observers, but they keep raising the debt ceiling and they do it. But the states can't do that. So what they would have to do is file for bankruptcy, but they're not allowed to file for bankruptcy either. But Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said that he would rather see them go bankrupt, he'd rather allow them to go bankrupt, like change the rules on that, than give them more money from Congress, free money, he says, because he thinks they'll use it to get out of trouble with their pension funds, and then we could go into whose fault that is that their pension funds even have a problem. So that just shows what the motivation here is. They've always, for a long time, the Republicans have wanted to privatize the pension funds and force everybody into 401ks, so they force them into the stock market, basically, which is highly risky. And then you can just go through these booms and busts and every 10 years wipe out the stock market and say, oops, sorry, and there goes everybody's pension except the savvy people that, you know, short-sold the market or sold early or whatever. So it's a major problem for the states. But unlike the states, we have the Federal Reserve, which has been very generous for the banks. And the banks weren't in trouble. I mean, it's not like the banks were going to go bankrupt. Their stocks were in trouble. Their stocks were going down, and that's probably it. They have anything that's big in the stock market got bailed out. So for the banks, what the Fed has done is to throw open the doors of the or the window of the discount window, where normally banks were hesitant to go, or, you know, just didn't go because normally had a higher interest rates than elsewhere. So if you went to the discount window, it's because nobody else would lend to you, which meant you must be in trouble, and then that would freak the stockholders, and then they would sell the stock. And so nobody wanted to do that. But now they've dropped the discount rate to 0.25%, which is like essentially free, dropped it from 1.5% to 0.25%. And the alleged reason is so that the banks will be more inclined to lend into the local economy to stimulate the economy in these dire times. But in fact, the credit card rates barely went down. I mean, they went from a little under 21% to a little over 20%. So they're still outrageously high for people that have just lost their jobs. So anyway, they haven't passed this bonanza on to their customers. Besides that, the Federal Reserve eliminated the reserve requirement. You don't have to really have any deposits. You can just keep going to the discount window. And at the discount window, they're making 90-day loans available, renewable daily. In other words, you can go there for your liquidity and count on it. And so you don't really need reserves. And for capital, they said you could use your capital for loans. That the reason that you were supposed to have this, you know, you're supposed to have 10% of your loan portfolio in capital. That's the bank's own money that can be hit up if you have defaults. But they said that was supposed to be emergency money, and this is an emergency, so you can use it. So basically, they don't have to worry about the capital requirement or the reserve requirement. They can just keep going to the Fed for their liquidity, for the money that they need to cover their loans. So that does present, I mean, which is a bit shocking and outrageous, but it does present a very nice opportunity for the state and local governments. Now is the time to get in there and set up their own banks, because that's been one of our big roadblocks against setting up public banks. I mean, it's easy for us to make the argument for why states should have them. They, you know, cut out the middleman, save a lot of money, direct the money where your local economy really needs it, escape your dependence on Wall Street, et cetera. Many good arguments, but one of the major barriers is coming up with capital, and another major barrier is coming up with enough deposits that will be there all the time. So now it seems we don't really need to worry about that so much. We can just, like the big banks, we could just, the state, let's say, could buy a little local bank, which would already have FDIC insurance and would already have a master account with the Federal Reserve, so they could already do, that doesn't mean you're a member of the Federal Reserve, but it means you're allowed to participate in the Fed system where you can trade with other banks, borrow from other banks, clear your checks with other banks, et cetera.
So let's pause there for just a moment, because in the architecture of state spending, what has been the case is that states have only been able to go to the bond market, which is a private market of issuing credit or debt. And now what you're suggesting, and I think what we're at this moment, where suddenly states should take a piece of the same sort of logic that the corporations and the banks have, which is to have access to the money pool, to the government money pool, just the same as corporations and banks have had, and have the same benefits. Because, as you point out, there's been a real deference to that crowd, to the hedge funds and the banks, but not to the states. So now is the moment. Now is the time. This is something that the Public Banking Institute has proposed in a letter to governors and treasurers this week. The letter to the governors was about that one of the recommendations was that
they should set up their own banks.
Because going forward, the bond market is not going to be interested in municipal and state debt. The states are not going to have their credit ratings are going to be a part of how much money they could get from the bond market, which is going to be expensive. But with the bank, they can move right around those barriers.
Yeah, and the Federal Reserve has opened a municipal liquidity facility where they will buy state municipal bonds, which is good because right now the bond market has, nobody wants to buy those bonds. They're dumping the bonds because, you know, they're dumping everything. All the investors are worried about everything. I think it's come back a bit. But that was the idea of it, to cover the bond market. But the problem is, even if the Fed buys the bonds, that's still debt. And if you can't go further into debt, if you got to balance your books, that's not going to help. You're still heading towards bankruptcy. Whereas having your own bank, you could have a credit line with yourself, essentially. I mean, what you're doing is mobilizing your own credit. So let's assume that you do rely totally on the Fed for liquidity, so you don't even have the deposits. You're borrowing at 0.25% instead of the bond rate. And it's your bank that's borrowing, not actually in a way, I suppose it is the state that's borrowing. I mean, if you're lending to the state for that purpose. But you're also generating lots of productivity for your local economy. You're creating jobs, putting people back to work. and isn't actually this the putting way, new money into the economy.
Yeah, and isn't this is a? It seems to me that's about the only way that states and cities are going to be able to move forward with covering both their expenses currently and the investments that are so desperately needed in infrastructure. I mean, that's been stuck for years.
Yeah. Well, another thing that I thought was interesting, why really did the Fed do this right now? The banks really didn't need it for, or they're really not using it to increase their lending, or it doesn't look like it. But in fact, the banks have had a liquidity problem that didn't start with this virus. It started, or the big sign of it was last September when the repo market rates shot up to 10%. So before 2008, banks borrowed from each other in the Fed funds market. And the Fed has always set the Fed funds rate, the interest rate that banks borrow from each other, and that was supposed to be the benchmark for all the other interest rates, and that's how they controlled the interest rate, or alleged they did. But after 2008, the banks didn't trust each other because it turned out some banks were actually bankrupt and couldn't pay back. So, and these were, of course, unsecured loans. So they turned to the repo market, which was supposedly secured with collateral. But the problem with collateral for the repo market is that it can be rehypothecated, which means lent several times over. So it, too, is quite risky. So apparently the hedge funds have now taken over the repo market, and they are notorious for their rehypothecation of collateral. And so the lenders, particularly the money market funds, pulled out of the repo market. They didn't want to lend their money anymore because they didn't trust it. So the Federal Reserve had to step in, or felt they did, because that's where the banks were getting their liquidity. And then that meant they were bailing out the whole repo market, not just the banks. So that would include the hedge funds and parties that supposedly the Fed isn't supposed to be lending to. So by opening up their discount window, they are getting control back. Like, only banks can bank at the discount window, and therefore they can set the rate there and help the banks, and they're not. Can't be accused of bailing out the hedge funds at the same time or backstopping the hedge funds at the same time. You know, the hedge funds would just go to the repo market and borrow day after day at very cheap rates and do all these things that we don't approve of.
Well, it's a violation of the Federal Reserve Act. A note in the Wall Street on Parade article by Pam and Russ Martins, citing DoubleLine CEO and bond guru Jeffrey Gundlach, said that the Fed is blatantly violating the Federal Reserve Act with its corporate bond purchases. He doubled down on that statement a couple of weeks before. It said that the Federal Reserve is presently acting in blatant noncompliance of the Reserve Act of 1913, an institution violating the rules of its own charter, is de facto admitting that said institution has failed and is fundamentally broken.
That's
what we're dealing with.
Yeah, but then what's interesting to me, if you look at it the other way, they are essentially the only game in town. I mean, everybody is conceding that the Fed is the only reliable place to get money. And that's what happened in the 1930s, too. Everybody rushed to the public banks, which were the postal banks then, because those were backed by the government. They were reliable. So it seems to me the Fed should clearly be nationalized. It's our credit. It's our money. It's our full faith and credit that backs all these loans. The banks really aren't lending their deposits. Of course, we knew that anyway, but now it's blatant that they're just going right to the Fed and can get money day after day after day, and they don't have to worry about borrowing short to lend long. You know, they can borrow there day after day, and they can make quite long loans, and they know that the Fed's always going to be there to provide the liquidity. So that's actually what I wrote about in my latest book, that I was banking on the people, that I was proposing that the Fed should be the central bank, or the full faith and credit of the United States should be the pool of money from which we all draw. We don't really have a money system. We have a credit system, and all our money is created as credits or debts, and it's extinguished when the debts are paid off. So we're clearly heading for a reset of some sort, financial reset. Agreed, the old the old system is not working. So they've sort of played their hand. They've showed what's going on behind the scenes, and therefore we can say, well, you don't really have standing to be independent. The whole idea of an independent Fed, now they're so independent that they're clearly choosing winners and losers and doing, like Gundlach says, doing things that they're just not legally allowed to do, and they're working at cross purposes against the people rather than serving the people.
Well, the direction in the legislature is at least starting to demonstrate some movement with that. Kirsten Gillibrand, senator from New York, proposed in new legislation this past week that the post office banking be revived as an essential and critical new element or revived element for protecting the people's money and also providing access.
Yeah, it's important for that other reason that you right now you've got all these problems of people even getting their very meager little $1,200 check, and particularly if they're unbanked or underbanked, where are they going to go to cash their check? So if you had easy post office access, there's a post office even in all these small towns that don't have banks, that would solve that problem. And the post office itself, you know, there's a push to private. There's always been a push to privatize it, but now it's getting worse because they want to privatize everything, supposedly to find the money, but they've already got the money. And the post office, you know, supports itself. It doesn't. It's not even drawing on taxpayer money. But if they were a postal bank, that would provide a source of income for the post offices, just like it does for post offices around the world that have postal banks and use that for their to supplement their letter carrying business, which is a loss loser because it doesn't just you only pay 50 cents to get a letter all the way across the country, which is pretty amazing.
Yeah, well, you can see that the long swords have come out in force. Of course, you illustrated McConnell calling for state bankruptcy. Trump has called for not supporting the post office unless it quadruples its rates, that because they want to privatize that, of course, too. And then you have the fox in the hen house with Steve Mnuchin, the foreclosure king, who has handed over the disposition and management of this trillions of dollars of our money to BlackRock, the world's biggest purveyor of special interest investment. So you see, the die is cast, and it seems to me that they've not only taken over our monetary system, but they really just don't care. They don't think they're going to get caught. They're not going to get caught. Who's going to put a stop to this? So it would seem to me that, you know, the idea that creating public banks as part of the, again, the architecture of public finance becomes a necessary intervention against letting Wall Street just run away with everything that they haven't already taken.
Yeah, and it could be done by executive order very quickly. The governors could just set them up. It wouldn't have to have any kind of physical structure. It can just be a banker's bank. I think there was a bank, if I recall correctly, I think it was for $13 million for sale in the East Bay in California. So it's not very much to buy a bank somewhere. And as one of our banking experts said, you could have a bank up and running in a month. So this could all be done very quickly, even though it took American Samoa 2 years. But that was because the Fed resisted giving them a master account.
We've been talking about the need for a consortium of governors and treasurers across the country to come together to take a stand for the right to have the same privileges that corporations and banks get at the Fed window, to come together and demand that public banks, that they be allowed access to the cheap credit, the liquidity that they deserve for the extensive equity that states and cities have. So maybe in the coming weeks we'll see something new develop on that front.
Right.
Well,
hopefully.
Yeah. Well, one final thing, of course, we're talking with Michael Schumann this week, who really was the person who addressed the question of who gets to invest their money into American investments and how local businesses have been left out of that realm, but that now more than ever, as the global economy collapses, the local economies need that that sort of input, and consequently new provisioning in securities laws and so forth are more timely, more important than ever. So we can move on to Michael and talk about that for a bit as the world turns around us. I guess we'll see what happens next, Ellen. Thank you so much for what you're doing with your articles. It's really opening eyes around the country.
Thank you. Always great to talk to you.
Bye.
Bye.
Before we head into our discussion with Michael Schumann, I thought it would be useful to refresh our understanding of from where all the history-changing, out-of-bounds practices recently undertaken by the Federal Reserve emanates. To expand the context beyond the COVID days current edition of their excesses, we can remember that it was only about 10 years ago that the Fed issued $29 trillion in loans to banks all over the world during the 2008 collapse. They did so for about 3 years without permission from Congress, and they hid it for 3 years until they were finally forced to disclose it by the courts. The Fed is not a government agency, though it plays one on TV under the guise of its governmental authority. The Fed is owned fundamentally and in its majority by the biggest banks and consistently operates in their interests. The public must scrounge for capital while the banks get virtually free money from the Fed. Here's your brief refresher from Michael Hudson.
You know, you have to represent the Fed as having been stolen economic and financial policy away from the public domain. It was part of the neoliberal project before neoliberalism really took form in Austria in the 1930s. You're picking up again, you're restoring the whole classical economic vision of productive versus unproductive credit, productive versus unproductive labor, and public money as opposed to private money. It's not that you're radical, that these people had a radical revolution to carve away the financial system from democracy, and you're restoring the classical vision of redemocratizing finance and banking.
So, as Michael just clearly described, is it any wonder that the corporations, banks, hedge funds, and other financial insiders get special treatment while the states and cities of America go begging? We frequently refer to the power of the people as being the power to make substantive changes in public policy and practices. But in recent years, so much of our economy has been dominated by an international focus that local financial power has been directed outward rather than inward through local investment, which is one of the things we favor so much about public banks. This is a key problem, according to our guest Michael Schumann, who's an attorney, economist, author, globally recognized expert in community economics. His books are numerous, including Local Dollars, Local Cents, The Small Mart Revolution, Going Local, and several others. Michael is a founding board member of BALI, the Business Alliance for Local Living Economies. He's been presenting his approach to alternative local investing systems for years. Here's our conversation with Michael Schumann.
Michael, you know, we have been living in a globalized world, and we have the most perverse of outcomes about globalization, where we see that the whole world is now sick in a viral way. But, of course, we've been sick from our own consumption and abuse of our environment and the real economy, which is nature. Globalization has now come back to haunt us and is a mighty opponent. How do you see us going from here in your matrix of economic formula?
I think this crisis is an invitation for us to jettison most of the assumptions that we've had for economic development for the last 200 years. And in my view, many of those assumptions are based on the thinking and the writings of David Ricardo, who is sort of the architect of trade and comparative advantage. And his basic argument was that the best economies in the world would be those that specialized in one or two things, became global class in the production of those things, and imported everything else. And I'm afraid too many communities embrace that. And the result is that we have brittle economies all over the world, and these economies have been devastated by the losses associated with this COVID-19 crisis. I think those communities that are somewhat more self-reliant, particularly those communities that took, for example, their food economy seriously, are going to weather this crisis better. So in my mind, the next step is figuring out how can we move communities worldwide on a trajectory toward greater self-reliance, a kind of world of self-reliant communities that are still connected to one another, not necessarily through dependency on trade, but through sharing of knowledge and experience and public policy and good ideas and culture. How can we build that kind of world out of the debris that we're going to have when this thing is over?
Yeah, I saw where they're dumping millions of eggs because they don't have the egg cartons to ship them in, and they get the egg cartons from China. So, I mean, I don't know how we'd remedy that. You probably can't make egg cartons locally, but you can certainly have local markets where you don't necessarily need egg cartons. So, yeah, I agree in principle.
Yeah, well, and perhaps we could have locally made egg cartons. And, you know, the way that I look at the economy now is that something close to, you know, between 70% and 80% of what we spend our money on is services. And that's one reason why this virus is so difficult, because services often require face-to-face connection. And it's very hard to do them well online, like, you know, say your dentist. But that said, the upside of services is that there's an inherent advantage to doing it locally. So the opportunity for most communities to become pretty self-sufficient in services is there. And then when we, you know, look at things like egg cartons, well, you know, when we goods, the other sort of 20 to 30% of what families are spending their money on, about three quarters of what we buy in goods is in so-called non-durable goods. So these tend to be things like food and paper products like the egg carton or building materials. And that's, you know, those are things by and large, as if you compare them to, say, electronics, that have a relatively low value per unit weight, whereas electronics have a high value and not a lot of weight. And things that are like electronics will still probably build globally on, you know, export platforms, whether it's Malaysia or Vietnam or China. But the things that weigh a lot in an era where transportation may get more and more expensive, I think those are things that it's going to make more sense to localize. And so maybe we won't be making an egg carton in every community, but certainly in every region, there will be paper producers.
So you're suggesting local economy is a regional geographic identity or coherence and interdependency.
And one of the very positive things that I think we're seeing out of this crisis is regional consortia of governors that are trying to get their reopening, to the extent that word means anything right now, but the reopening of their economies in sync. So, you know, New England governors, Mid-Atlantic governors, the Upper Great Lakes governors, the West Coast governors. And then, of course, you also have compacts of governors who are doing it wrong in the South. But c'est la vie. I mean, it just shows that I think states are realizing that they're not going to get help from the federal government on this, and they best rely on one another.
Yeah, it does seem that there is a thrust toward a new kind of a confederacy, you know, a sub-federal organizational status or strata that would allow for all kinds of new collaboration. But Wall Street has been really one of the great uniters. In fact, it's, of course, the dominant ruling power over and above, of course, our democratic structures. And it, too, continues to extract in the midst of the new things that are being handed out. But how in the world is that kind of momentum with that kind of global backdrop going to fare? How can we stop it, basically? You've talked about ending Wall Street, not repairing it.
Right. So, I mean, there's sort of two related components to Wall Street. I mean, we probably could create a much more fine template as well, but just broadly speaking, the banking segment and the securities segment, and both of them, but for enormous federal subsidies, both of them would have collapsed years ago. And I think that if you go back to the last financial crisis in 2008, I mean, one of the ways of thinking about not just the direct bailout of some of the companies like AIG, but also the indirect subsidies that were provided by quantitative easing, I think that those subsidies, which really amount to trillions of dollars, are the reason why many of these big institutions have survived in the banking sector. And then on the securities side, I mean, one of the things that I've pointed out is that we have this perversity in our economy right now where, depending on how you count it, how you define the word local, something like 60 to 80% of our economy by jobs and output are in locally owned business. And yet those businesses receive almost none of the securities investments that we make in our pension funds. And not just pension funds, but mutual funds and insurance funds and just more casual buying of stocks and bonds. But all of that goes to Wall Street rather than to Main Street. And the reason is that we constructed a set of securities laws that made it cheap and easy for big companies to get capital and made it really expensive and difficult for small companies to. And if we fix that, I think that you will see a huge shift of capital from Wall Street to Main Street. And that's one opportunity that this crisis presents, that both on the banking front and in the securities front, there may be a political openness and also a desperation to really try something different, given how hard people's lives are going to be right now.
How would you shift it, though? I mean, the problem is the corporatocracy owns the government, and we can't, I mean, it's pretty obvious that the states need money right now, for example, but they didn't give anything in this latest bailout that they just did, and there's, you know, the alternative is to let the states go bankrupt, and,
right.
And that's what they seem to want to do, to get rid of the pension funds. I mean, the pension funds do have money. I was thinking maybe the pension funds should start their own bank. They've got money that they could just move over into capitalizing a bank. Right now they can borrow for 0% interest from the Fed, and there's no reserve requirement. So it seems to me you don't even necessarily, well, they've got plenty of money for deposits. Anyway,
yeah.
It's hard to see the mechanics of how we'll shift. It's a good idea to say, yeah, we definitely need to shift focus and this is what we should do, but how do we implement that? That's the hard part to me.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, and so I recently wrote a blog piece called 12 Asks from our governors, because I do think it's going to be a lot easier to move this kind of agenda, however imperfectly, at the state and local level than at the national level. And let's just stipulate that moving things at the national level would be great if we could figure out how to wave our political magic wand. But I think at the state level, again, both in the banking area and in the securities area, there's a lot that can be done. And I mean, I'm, you know, along with you, Ellen, I'm a great enthusiast of public banking. I think that, you know, gradually there have been movements that have been underway in a couple of dozen states and even in some municipalities. And I think this crisis may be just enough to tip the balance into getting states to take some action. I don't know. What do you think about that?
I agree. What specific action would you recommend that we recommend? We're always pushing public banks, of course. But then the question, we were hoping that they would be able to tap into some of the money that supposedly there was $150 billion that was going to go to the states under the original CARES Act. But they've circumscribed what you can use it for so that you really couldn't use it for that. I mean, you pretty much have to use it for, like, doctors and things that are immediately related to this virus, which means a lot of that money is just going to go to waste. I mean, they can't use it, for example, to make up for the lost revenues due to this virus. Like if it was in last year's budget, they can't use it to make up for those costs that they now don't have the money for.
Right. So there are a bunch of plausible places where a state could draw money for creating a public bank, and federal resources is one of them, and that may be slow. I mean, what I was always struck by with, the kind of baseline case of the Bank of North Dakota was how they used existing flows of money from taxpayers in the state and from federal transfer payments that were just happening as a matter of course, and used those funds as a way of building up their capital base, rather than putting that money on deposit in foreign companies.
That would be the deposits, but I'm concerned about, in order to get a charter from the Department of Business Oversight here in California, we're going to have to come up with capital, which is the bank's own money, not deposits.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where we're stuck. I don't know that we even need deposits. If now that they've done away with the reserve requirement, it seems to me you could borrow at 0% interest for all your liquidity. But how do we get the money to start the bank in the first place? And we have
so
to,
the other,
go ahead.
Yeah. No, I was going to say that, in a way, this is where the other side of the equation, the security side, is important because, you know, if a bank draws in owners in the form of stock or some other kind of ownership scheme, those would be securities. And I think there is a growing interest, you know, given that the stock market has lost 20% of its value, I think there's going to be a growing interest from investors, even some mainstream investors, to look at other alternatives of where to park their money. And if I was looking at a public bank that was underwritten by, you know, the taxpayers of California, I would think that would be a very good investment.
So where in the securities law, or what part of securities law, which you've been instrumental in helping to change for crowdfunding purposes, what else needs to be done there to facilitate more local or regional investment funds?
So I think one way of thinking about the universe of investing is that there are sort of four discrete things that people do. And the first is that they buy securities from businesses or governments or other entities. The second is that they often resell those on stock markets or other kinds of exchanges. The third thing is that they bundle them together in funds to diversify their securities against risk, against, you know, some of these securities going bad, but also to get them professionally managed, because sometimes it's difficult to do this all on your own. And then the fourth thing is sort of the nexus between mainstream institutions, like everything from pension funds to foundations to labor unions, the nexus between those big chunks of money and all of these funds out there that they might invest in, that's, you know, governed by a federal law called ERISA. And so that's a whole separate kind of discussion. And so what's happened in the last 10 years is that the very first thing, so the rules wrote on the issuance of securities have been changed both at the federal level and changed in, at this point, about 37 states. And it is now using, you know, say investment crowdfunding, any small business go online and put some kind of ask for money, whether in the form of debt or stock investment or a royalty agreement. And they can do this for up to about $1.1 million with very, very little paperwork and expense up front. So that's a big, big change. And there's a lot of talk right now about shifting that law a little bit and making that ceiling more like $5 million for a company. And right now, we're allowing every individual to invest up to $2,000 per year. So maybe that could be raised to $10,000 per year. But that's just the very, very first thing on the issuance of securities. The laws around the resale in stock markets, the formation of investment funds, and the laws around institutional investments, they are still totally obsolete, and we've got to bring those into the 21st century as well. So, I mean, one idea that I've had is that the Securities and Exchange Commission should just say to the states, look, just as we allow you to set your own laws about the issuance of securities that are only held by people in your state, we're going to do the same thing about local stock markets and local investment funds. You set the rules and you be creative, and we're going to see what works out there. And that would just open up all kinds of possibilities. And I'll give you one example, which is in Nova Scotia, the province of Nova Scotia, in 1998, when they realized that, you know, all of their pension money was going out of the province and into big banks in Toronto and Montreal, They decided, you know what, we're going to make it easier for communities to set up their own pension funds. 70 of those funds have since been set up. And now, you know, there is this really interesting option in Nova Scotia for people to invest, say, in the local food pension fund or the local manufacturing pension fund, all of which are connected with smallish businesses in the province. And we're talking about a province with 1 million people. That could happen in the United States.
That's a very exciting example. How are they doing?
They believe they could be doing a lot better. So even though I think it's a great model, I mean, it still only captures a relatively small percentage of the money that people have in their savings. And I think the reason is that even though they fixed this one piece of their investment environment, they still make it very difficult for companies to raise capital through crowdfunding. So they're not as far along as we are in that. And also a lot of people and a lot of companies are unaware of these funds and haven't really dipped their toe in the water of it yet. So that's why, you know, another piece that I think is important at the state level is to educate investors and businesses about new opportunities for local investment, because it doesn't happen automatically. And it's, the same would be true with a public bank. I mean, you could set up a public bank and people would not automatically gravitate toward it. You need marketing and you need education.
Right. Yeah, well, the public banks we're thinking of would be bankers' banks, basically. So, but yeah, what we need in general is education. I mean, I think they need to change the state banking rules for how to charter a bank or what you need to charter a bank. Right now they're making it so difficult because, you know, there's a lot of pressure from Wall Street. We don't need more banks. You know, we don't need competition from the state to have its own bank. But as a, when during a crisis, that is when regulators are willing to change the rules because they see that they've, you know, they really have no alternative but to do something totally different.
Yeah. Well, I do think that there is a growing public awareness about this. And what I've noticed is that, you know, every time you tell people about the Bank of North Dakota or, you know, even just halfway measures that communities around the country are entertaining, there's a lot of interest in it. Banks, especially big banks, have not become people's favorite institutions. So I feel like politically, even in among conservatives, there's a lot of interest in looking for alternatives.
Yeah, we've been surprised to get support from all quarters. I mean, all different political parties. There is something in it for everyone. For conservatives, it's all about state sovereignty, keeping your money in the state, not sending it off to Wall Street to leverage for their own purposes. And for the left, it's all about providing for your local community, for providing for your local businesses and people.
One of the examples that you gave in one of your presentations, I think it was in Australia, was in New Brunswick, and how they provide tax credits, tax incentives for local investment. Has that been a profitable sort of a channel for them as well?
So, as is true in neighboring Nova Scotia, it is an amazing secret that even many of the people of New Brunswick are unaware of. But indeed, wow, their law is that for every dollar of local investment you put into, you know, a qualified locally owned business in New Brunswick above $1,000, you get 50% off of your provincial taxes. And I will say that there is a bill that's been introduced in the Michigan State House to do the same thing. I would have pegged its chances of passage pre-COVID as modest to low. I think it has a very good chance of passing now, because I think that there is a lot of interest by the governor and others in the legislature to take some fundamentally new approaches to getting people to reinvest locally. And there's, you know, there's another innovation from Canada too that's worth talking about, which is in the provinces of Alberta and British Columbia, they have co-ops, which are investment vehicles. So in the United States, co-ops are usually built around consumers, like an REI, Recreational Equipment Incorporated, or they're built around producers, farmer producer co-ops. But they're not really allowed to be used for investment purposes, except for some discrete categories like housing. But in Alberta and British Columbia, they allow communities to set up co-ops explicitly for economic development purposes. People are allowed to, you know, become members, and they put in a couple of $1,000s of capital as their membership, and then they do investment in local businesses. And a lot of what they've done is, and again, this is pre-COVID, I mean, they've taken businesses that, say, had succession problems where the owner was going to retire and there was not an obvious successor to take the business, take over ownership of the business. So the co-op would step in and sort of ease the transition to a new set of owners so that that business that was a major employer or a major supplier in a community was able to survive.
Yeah, and if they turned them into actual co-ops, that's even better, owned by the workers.
Yep,
and
exactly.
An interesting data point about Alberta, the largest public bank in the Northern Hemisphere is in Alberta, the Alberta Trust Branch, which is $50 billion in assets. So there are all of these examples, so many examples of what could be possible and what might get done. Michael, is there, in your awareness, who is kind of leading the development, these local revenue systems we should know about?
Well, I will say that overall, this is a movement without coherence or a name or an organized structure, and it needs one, and that's why these conversations are so important. There's a couple of groups that I've been working closely with that I think are good to put on your radar screen. One is called the National Coalition for Community Capital, which is about 3 years old, and it's all about promoting reform and improvements of grassroots investing opportunities at the state and local level. Another organization, which is a little bit newer, is called the Next Egg. And the Next Egg is all about this, really what I've written about in my most recent book, which is called Put Your Money Where Your Life Is, which is how to take your pension savings individually, whether they're in 401ks or IRAs, and move that money into local business, local projects, or local people. And it turns out that there's some interesting ways of doing that. And, you know, no matter what our project du jour is, whether it's building new local businesses or local banks or some other project that we want people to invest in that maybe bonds will be issued from, that figuring out how you can make it easier for people to move their own money is a very powerful way of getting them to rethink their priorities. You know, and it's worth also saying that your own priorities are not just investing in other businesses. It also could be investing in yourself, getting yourself out of credit cards, getting your kids out of student loans, getting your neighbors out of being renters and into owning houses or paying down their mortgage more quickly. All of these things could be uses of your capital that could generate really good rates of return vis-a-vis the wobbly stock market.
And Michael, you've got resources that you'd like to share with our audiences too. Where would you like people to find your work?
Most of my work is posted on my website, which is michaelhshuman.com, and Schuman is S-H-U-M-A-N. And as I mentioned a little earlier, I do have a book that comes out in June called Put Your Money Where Your Life Is, How to Invest Locally Using Self-Directed IRAs and Solo 401ks. And that might be a good entry point into thinking about how you can participate in this local investment revolution. Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak with you today.
Thank you for speaking with us.
Thanks, Michael.
Well, that's it for this edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Our thanks to our guests, our sponsor, Public Banking Associates, and to you for listening. Be sure to check out Ellen's latest writings on the economy and the changing world of money by visiting ellenbrown.com. And for more information on public banking, visit publicbankinginstitute.org. For information on how local and state government leaders can obtain professional insight and counsel about public banks from key national experts, visit publicbankingassociates.com. I'm Walt McCree. See you next time on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown.